You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. It's Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. And right now, I've got a fascinating conversation with Australian novelist Kim Scott. Kim is a descendant of the Noongar people of Western Australia. He's a two-time winner of the Miles Franklin Literary Award for his novels Benang and That Dead Man Dance. And his latest novel, the novel we're going to be talking about today, is Taboo. Taboo is an extraordinary ensemble novel that broadly tells the story of invasion and dispossession as a group of Noongar people return to their ancestral land, long considered taboo since the massacre of their people generations before. The story explores how generations of separation have not dimmed their connection to the land, telling a story that engages with Australia's current history and the broader discussion around acknowledgement of the traditional owners of this country who never ceded or gave up their claims to the land. Kim and I had a fascinating discussion exploring the role of language and country in telling a contemporary story that engages with history's reverberations. I thought it was just this extraordinary ensemble novel. The characters you've created are amazing. And I really wanted to start with the novel's opening, which, you know, is also conveniently its conclusion. And I was really interested in the way you play with tropes and stereotypes in those first few pages. You seem to be invoking fairy tale, there's sort of a zombie horror element, elements of magical realism, the animated skeleton that seems to walk, a dramatic out-of-control careering vehicle, and there's that farcical turn where the character that we don't yet know, he's just a well-dressed man fleeing the scene. Each of these moments, though, they set up and then they thwarted my expectation of what Taboo might hold. But what about for you, for the weight of expectation? How does that help you or hinder you as a writer?
Yeah, I suppose in the drafting it might be me searching a little bit, but I am thinking about reader expectations. And I want to, because I have that critter that appears, and I have to enable that as I see it. I don't think I've written a contemporary novel before, a novel set in contemporary time. And I've worried a bit about doing that because of social realism, meaning that you end up wallowing in two apparent empirical realities of Indigenous life, all the bad social indicators and the sensationalising some of that. So I've got a bit of that in the novel, I think, but particularly because I'm sorry this is a clumsy answer, but I wanted to, yes, not wallow in social realism, not be bogged down in that, and I wanted to set up some sort of possibilities of mythic resonances around what I was doing, the ancient language, a community returning to place. So the biblical reference early on, the little fairy tale business, the genre hopping generally was to try and enable that.
So Taboo it's about a coming together and a return, a group of Noongar people gathering in Kepalup for a commemoration of a peace park. There's this idea that it's an initiative designed to heal relationships between black and white for years of brutal history. The land that they're returning to is considered taboo for the massacres that have been committed there. And you also unfold the damage that's been inflicted on the land through the book as fertile ground was cleared, ultimately made barren. I was hoping, though, you could help me understand a little bit more this the role of and place of land in the story.
Yes. Look, it certainly is people returning to ancestral country, and they're damaged by history, and there's non-Aboriginal characters in the same sort of plight, in a way, damaged by our history. And there's healing and transformation, I would add, that occurs because of that communal return. Place, as you've indicated, I also do some Gothic stuff, I think, in terms of the landscape, not only an individual female character, but the landscape being hostile, and then I turn that around over the course of the novel. The stress put on language and those people returning to place is all about I'm trying to play with manifestations of the spirit of place in an Aboriginal sense. So language is a clear part of that, I think, in the novel. But so are all those individuals that are living there are manifestations of the spirit of place, perhaps including the non-Aboriginal characters. So the reconciling, for want of a better word, and the working out of relationships, not only with one another, but with place and the place's cultural heritage, are all part of what I'm exploring.
Tilly is the brave and resilient character at the centre of your story. I found it was perhaps easy to see her as representing a new generation who brings hope, but she's also scarred by her own story. You brought me back to ideas of fairy tale and the gothic, where so many young protagonists are captured and suffered at the hands of truly evil characters. If I think about fairy stories we're brought up with, we always forget how horrible the things that happen. In such a rich ensemble cast, so what was Tilly's role for you? What were you hoping to convey through her?
There's a number of things about the strength you gain, one can gain from reconnecting with a ancestral country, heritage, and a home community of descendants. The importance of people doing that, particularly young people, and the narrative it offers them. I was also working with, again in the Wheelerman Project, a level of some of the things that recur as sort of motifs or archetypes. One is a young protagonist journeying alone away from home and family and returning enriched because of the challenges and contests she or he has succeeded in, returning enriched and better able to contribute to their home community. That's something I have Tilly go through in a way. And also another recurring sort of motif in many older Noongar stories that I know is of a character being killed, in fact, in those sort of contests with evil, a devil character normally. And to cut it short, being brought back to life by another community member with their breath, often with their language, and certainly through their companionship. So it's those sort of things I think I never intended Tilly as the central character, but that's how things work. So that's the sort of things I was playing with, I think.
Her story's really rich and multifaceted. We have several iterations of her, and I think you play around with the way you present who she is with this sort of disjointed timeline. But there's a point sort of later in the book where we're joining Tilly at the school that she goes to, and there's an Aboriginal support officer, Maureen, who... I wasn't sure if she was meant to be a sort of a farcical character. She's a completely ridiculous but kind of horrifying in the way that she keeps expecting the students to perform their Aboriginality and telling them what is right and what is wrong. In Tilly's story, were you trying to complicate, I guess, a very colonial white idea that somehow Aboriginality is only one thing?
Yeah, no, she represents... There's a lot of... From my perspective, there's quite a lot of expectation on people, notions of authentic Aboriginality. And sometimes it's people in ignorant but nevertheless privileged in different ways that want to articulate those and want to see some of us conforming to them. So that's... And the dangers and reductionism in that is what I was... playing with there. So you have someone like Tilly, vulnerable, insecure at this stage about her, who she is, and then you have others who've got no right to be articulating it, telling her how she should be as an Aboriginal person. Yeah, I thought it was farcical, satirical, with a nasty edge to it.
Language plays an incredibly important role in Taboo, and there are a couple of threads that I wanted to pick up. As you've touched on there, we travel through the landscape of the novel, and different characters enrich their scenery, naming, and this is particularly I found for Tilly, the naming traditional sites, features, and animals, helping to teach her about her land, her place that she doesn't really fully understand. What, though, does... This is a very contemporary debate around the loss and revival of language do for you in shaping the narrative of taboo?
If I don't use much Noongar language, I'd say...
I notice that, yeah.
Yeah, I say the ancient tongue, the old people, the way the old people talk, et cetera, et cetera. That's partly because there's many endangered or frail Aboriginal languages across the continent, and I want to be talking about all of them in a way. I also want to emphasise strategically a parallel between this continent's ancient languages and those more prevalent in the Northern Hemisphere, and what they have made to what difference they've made to cultural renaissance. And this may connect to your question about place previously. So, for instance, if I am correct in thinking that some sort of European cultural renaissance occurred hundreds of years ago with people following people digging up broken statues and shards of pottery and rediscovering and reclaiming an ancient languages, what might that mean here when it's not just broken statues and pottery shards we're digging up, its landscape is the text for some of these stories. So that's part of what I'm playing with. And of course, I am deeply involved, contingent to writing this novel, the last couple of novels, with a language cultural consolidation revitalization project, the Wilam and Noongar Language and Stories Project, which informs this novel. And I've seen ways in which recovering and sharing language can transform power relationships and can give people, can give us a different narrative to talk about what it means to be living here and to talk about our history in a different sort of way and to do something other from an Aboriginal perspective, a Noongar perspective, something other than just a sort of reactive, trapped narrative.
And I found running through taboo and juxtaposing this revival of Noongar languages, but also the broader discussion around revival of languages and revival of culture, we have the way the English language, the way white language occupies a place that is deeply unsettling. So we've got Dan Horton, he's the white farmer, he occupies the traditional lands where the local Aboriginal people were massacred generations before. But throughout the novel, you have him, he's continually evincing this discomfort at the use of the word massacre. He sort of keeps sort of saying things along the line of, I wish you wouldn't use that word, I don't like that word, whilst he does seem to acknowledge the wrongs that were done. How powerful is this language in the discussion? Do you have any thoughts on why it's so hard for people to use words like massacre and to face it?
Yeah, well, I guess it's certainly psychologically unsettling. Yeah, Dan is trying really hard, and everyone is a little bit trapped in the narratives of guilt and victimhood. And I guess it is very hard to say it was a massacre, to admit the extent of the atrocity. The other languages that people are working with, the other language that people are working with in this story, they probably can say it, even though it might mean the same thing. It's just because of the resonances to do with guilt and evil, particularly, that flow from massacre is what Dan has trouble with. And he struggles, as many of us do, just to confront if not the truth of history, then certainly other valid perspectives on it.
You are on 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, and you were just listening there to my conversation with Kim Scott about his latest novel, Taboo.